Doctors applying to practice in Arizona had faced an added hurdle. The state stopped issuing licenses. Will the workaround help alleviate the state's doctor shortage?
We will lose licensed health professionals if we can't do this in a reasonable amount of time for a reasonable cost.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, clearing the backlog. Also, early ballots are going out, but some candidates have gone underground.
Red, white, blue, green, what makes a compelling campaign sign? What do we got to do to attract more manufacturing jobs?
And an opera where the usual rules of decorum do not apply.
The first time the mariachi starts playing, we have a huge ovation from the people. They all start clapping no matter what's going on.
Plus, the known unknowns and deep-fried history.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. And good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for this weekend looks like we'll be drying out under sunny skies. Should have a high tomorrow of 92 and then 90 degrees on Sunday. Currently, it's still pretty humid, though. Relative humidity nearly 40%, and it's 86 degrees. Quick check of traffic. There is one trouble spot to avoid. I-17 southbound, you will not be able to use the Northern Avenue on-ramp.
A federal judge wants to hear from the two sides arguing over Arizona's ban on same-sex marriage. He's given them a week to submit papers discussing how a higher court's move affects the Arizona case. KJZZ's Nick Blumberg reports.
In an order late Thursday, Judge John Sedgwick said a ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in favor of gay marriage in Idaho and Nevada appears binding in the case against Arizona's ban. He gave plaintiffs and defendants 7 days to file briefs discussing how the Ninth Circuit decision applies. Both sides have already asked the judge to rule without a full trial, so a decision in the Arizona case could come relatively quickly. The Arizona Attorney General's office on Friday wouldn't say whether it will continue defending the state's ban. But a spokesperson said lawyers aren't yet sure they agree that the Ninth Circuit ruling applies in this case. Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The manufacturer of sapphire glass that Apple uses to make iPhones says it wants to shut down a Mesa factory that was once touted as a big job creator for Arizona. GT Advanced Technologies filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection this week. In a bankruptcy court filing today, the company outlined its plans to wind down operations at the Mesa factory by the end of the year, along with a second facility in Massachusetts. The move will leave hundreds of people out of work.
Less than a month before elections, a federal judge in Texas has struck down that state's voter ID law. KJZZ's Monica Ortiz-Uribe reports the judge characterized the law as discriminatory against African Americans and Latinos.
U.S. District Judge Nelva Gonzalez Ramos called the law requiring Texas voters to present a government-issued identification a, quote, unconstitutional poll tax. She issued her ruling Thursday evening. The state legislature passed the law in 2011 as a means to prevent voter fraud, but records from the state attorney general's office show only 18 convictions for voter fraud from 2002 to 2012. Meanwhile, the Justice Department says 600,000 registered voters in Texas lack the proper ID to cast a ballot. Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott, who is the Republican nominee for governor, said he will appeal the ruling. Monica Ortiz-Uribe, KJZZ News, El Paso.
The body that licenses doctors in Arizona this week decided to start reissuing medical licenses. It had stopped last month because of a dispute over a new state law requiring criminal background checks for applicants. Greg Vigder, president and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association, says the resolution was important for the state.
I think reasoned heads prevailed, and we found an alternative way to move forward in solving that problem, and so the board is open for business again. And that's a really important thing and a good start for solving the bigger problem.
The law in question required the board to submit applicants' fingerprints to the FBI for a background check, but the feds were balking. So the medical board decided that instead it'd require applicants to sign a notarized statement that they do not have criminal convictions. If that turns out not to be true, they'll have their license revoked.
Vigder says the board has a backlog of around 700 physicians waiting for licenses. It's not clear how many of them were affected by the board essentially shutting down. Vigder says the situation could have lasting damage.
Us getting these 700 physicians through is not going to solve our physician shortage. Us not getting through is going to make it worse. And it certainly does send a message to applicants around the nation that this is a tough state to come to, and that's the last thing we want.
Arizona is facing a doctor shortage, and it's likely that not all of the 700 physicians in the queue for a license will end up practicing here. Dan Dirksen, director of the Center for Rural Health at the University of Arizona Medical School, says the medical board's workaround seems reasonable, but he says there have to be expectations about the time it takes to get a license.
It's definitely a problem, and I think it's always good when you do legislation like this, maybe not in the bill itself, but through the regulation process, to make sure that there's a reasonable cycle time so that once a physician submits their information, that there should be a reasonable expectation that that's done within 30 to 90 days is the generally acceptable time. And if it's going to take longer than that, that there's some sort of workaround in place so that a person could get a provisional license or be allowed to start practicing until the other information comes in. There's ways to make sure that the public safety is protected through the licensing process, but also that licenses get handled in an expeditious manner so that we aren't losing potential health providers because our cycle time is too long.
Do you think that potential physicians looked at that waiting list, looked at that queue and said, yeah, no thanks, I'll just go somewhere else?
Well, you know, when you're competing with other states for a scarce commodity, you have to make sure you're user-friendly and that your turnaround time is reasonable. And when you have four or five offers, as many of our graduates do, to go practice in other areas or other states or other communities, you can lose people, definitely.
Do you see what the board has done, this workaround? Do you see this as a permanent solution or something that will need to be reworked potentially when the legislature comes back into session in January?
Well, I'm not sure this requires a legislative fix of adjusting a bill or a regulatory fix in the rulemaking process. I think a natural thing to do would be to look at best practices from other states to create some expectations for a state licensing board as far as cycle time. I really like what the nurses have done in this part of the country where they have a compact where, you know, you get a license and basically once that very stringent process is followed, that license is verified and used by other states. You don't have to go through it, you know, 15 and 20 different times for other ones. You know, physicians haven't done that as much in the licensing boards, and there's pluses and minuses for doing that type of thing. But there has to be a much more efficient way to do this that protects the public safety, but also makes sure that we aren't losing, you know, a precious commodity that's really affecting access to high-quality patient care in these communities that are having trouble recruiting and retaining health professionals. We will lose licensed health professionals if we can't do this in a reasonable amount of time for a reasonable cost. And I think that's the intention all the way around of these things. And I think this will sort through over the next 6 to 12 months and we'll come up with a much better process.
Dan Dirksen is a professor and director of the Center for Rural Health at the U of A Med School. He's also a family physician.
As Jan Brewer's time as governor dwindles down to just a few months, she took a trip to Europe this week in the hopes of attracting jobs from Norway and Ireland to Arizona. But what else does the state need to be doing to snag positions that are otherwise ending up in Mexico or the Deep South? Professor Arnie Maltz of the W.P. Carey School at ASU specializes in supply chain management.
The first thing that might work, and it's, you know, it's a might, but it might work, is being close to key raw materials. Now, I think Arizona's doing some mining these days. We've got copper here. If somebody needs copper for some reason to actually do something, you know, raw copper out of the ground or some kind of ore, there'd be a benefit to that. The second thing I can imagine is if someone would prefer not to be in Mexico but wants to serve that marketplace, this is happening, but again, it's not manufacturing so much. Someone who believes that their major markets are going to be California.
How important are wages?
Well, they're important, but the thing to remember is that, A, we're never going to compete with Mexico on wages. The key stuff that is likely to come back, and I'm coming back to the U.S. as opposed to coming back to Mexico, is likely to be high-value stuff that can be generally has a low labor content in the manufacturing operation, so it can be highly automated. That's what everybody's bringing back. It doesn't matter. It's not just Arizona. It's literally everybody's bringing that stuff back at this point.
BMW, for example, Mercedes, and I'm thinking about, they've also expanded to Mexico, of course, but I'm thinking more even in the deep south. What is it that an Alabama, a Tennessee, a Mississippi might have that Arizona wouldn't have?
Well, for one thing, they're going to have a larger labor force in general. Second thing they're going to have is that they're probably more comfortable for the Europeans. And that's because of the kind of culture you're dealing with there. We're talking about places that are, call it genteel if you want anything else. The third thing is that those guys are hardcore right-to-work states, even more hardcore than Arizona. There, they've broken the unions. And frankly, the fourth thing is that all the suppliers are there. When the Detroit guys moved down south, they brought their suppliers with them.
When Governor Brewer, for example, or any governor from any state, not just Arizona, goes on a trade trip, what antenna go up for you?
It depends. I think like most of these kinds of trips, it depends on the preparation that was done beforehand. If she's got clear ideas of who she's going to talk to, and I'm using she because it's Governor Brewer right now, but anybody, if the staff has really gotten what we would call a qualified lead, then it may make sense. I mean, there are situations where at a certain level, and, you know, think about the guy at Alibaba, for example, he's not going to be interested in dealing with even the Arizona Commerce Authority. He's going to want to talk to the top person. Similarly, when, Michael Crow was in the room with Tesla. So they're going to want to talk to the very top people. And if she can make the start on that and indicate that that's happening and it's a qualified lead, fine. If it's just kind of let's be nice to each other, then I'm as skeptical as you are.
Professor Arnie Maltz of the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news. So there are a bunch of TVs in our newsroom, and over the past week or so, it's been pretty much impossible to look up from your computer for even a minute without seeing a string of political commercials one after another.
Early ballots will be in mailboxes in the next day or so, and what some analysts call election month is officially on, but some candidates are easier to spot than others. Check out this exchange from KAET's Arizona Horizon show. During a debate late last month between Superintendent of Public Instruction candidates David Garcia, a Democrat, and Republican Diane Douglas.
The first week of October, there are five debates in four different counties. I have confirmed my attendance to every single one of those, and I'm asking my opponent to do the same.
I am not, sir, allowing you to run my campaign schedule. I thank you very much for wanting to be my scheduler, but I have a very capable, wonderful woman doing that, and I'm here to talk about education.
To debate or to not debate, Laura Brown with the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University says candidates leading in the polls generally want fewer debates, while those behind often push for more.
I do think voters see debates as being kind of the most honest form of campaigning that could exist, right? It gives them a place where they can actually see the candidates side by side, where neither side is, if you will, a packaged paid political advertisement. And so I do think that voters like the concept of debates, and they like that notion that they can actually see these people up close, live, personal, and in a real spontaneous way. The flip side of that is that not many people, when the debates happen, in fact, tune into debates or bother to go hear them. And this is part of, I would argue, the sort of reason why many candidates can get away with not engaging in debates.
I'm curious about one of the words you used just now, which is spontaneous. And it seems to me that when you watch debates, there's not a lot of spontaneity, that candidates have their talking points almost irrespective of what the question to them is. They sort of know what they're going to answer before the question's even done. Given the fact that candidates sort of approach debates a certain way now, can you imagine a time where they're just not done anymore, like people just don't care enough because they can see what a candidate's going to say in a commercial, in their stump speech, by going to their website, something like that?
Well, certainly, if you look at the decline in viewership of the presidential debates over time, which has been pretty significant, it does suggest that too much of this stump speech talking in the debate format is not necessarily attracting viewers. But I think that, you know, the voters, as I said, like to believe that there will be some authentic moment, that a candidate may be caught off guard, that a candidate may respond out of something that is personal to them or surprising to them.
It kind of sounds like you're saying that folks watch debates almost for one of the reasons people watch NASCAR is to wait for a crash.
Well, I think there's definitely a part of that.
Laura Brown is with the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. By the way, she says in a given race, three debates is probably enough. Catherine Alonzo, founding partner of the Phoenix-based campaign consulting firm Javelina, says the strategy is different for each candidate.
Whenever you look at a campaign and a candidate's schedule, you should be able to tell what the campaign strategy behind it is. So if you are doing public appearances, if you're doing debates, if you're running statewide and you're spending a lot of time in a particular part of the state, you should be able to tell by looking at the candidate's calendar what some of the underlying assumptions of the campaign strategy is.
Have you had candidates that you've worked for who haven't wanted to do debates and you've had to try to talk them into it or convince them that they should be doing this?
I haven't had that experience. I've more had the experience when working with people and the person we're running against is ducking debates, and that can be a challenge. And I think oftentimes it's because this perception that if you're in the lead, you don't need to be on a public stage as much. And oftentimes it can be when there are two candidates stacked against each other and one has more natural ability, is a good speaker, takes command of the stage, then there can be some nervousness from the opponent to not want to go up against that.
So when you're working with a candidate whose opponent won't debate them, how much of an issue do you make that?
It depends what we think the reason is. And this is the other thing. If there are really worrying things in a candidate's record, in their issue stances that we think that they're trying to avoid, and they don't want to be put on a public stage because they don't want to be put on the spot, that's an issue. That's something that voters need to know about. So that's definitely something that we would definitely focus on.
Do average voters watch debates? Do they listen to debates? Is there anything that comes out of a debate that might actually enlighten a voter who's legitimately trying to figure out who to vote for?
I think yes. It depends a little bit on the office. The higher profile the race is, I think more people pay attention to debates. On the presidential level, I think debates have been many times credited with being a turning point in campaigns. And the televised statewide debates get a lot of attention. There was, you know, a very famous moment when Governor Brewer ran for re-election that became a talking point in the campaign. So, yes, I think that they're very important. The further you get down the ballot, the smaller the audience, and therefore probably the less number of undecided voters there are. You know, sometimes you can go to a local debate and you may feel like there are one or two people in the room that are genuinely undecided. It doesn't diminish the importance of those undecided voters.
Catherine Alonzo is founding partner of the campaign consulting firm Javelina.
Most major intersections have political campaign signs on their corners. But since some have been up for more than 6 months, first for the primary election and now for the general, you'd be forgiven for not noticing them anymore and having them fade into the horizon. Recently, I went to Priest and Rio Salado Parkway in Tempe with artist Peter Bug, who's gallery director at ASU in the Herberger Institute of Design and the Arts. I wanted to find out what signs he thought were effective, regardless of political party.
I notice there's a lot of red, white, and blue, but the thing that gets my eyes more is whether or not there's any color other than that, and if there is something other than a plain white background.
And what about lettering, whether it's capital or a mix, or whether you've got different sorts of fonts?
Something that does stand out to me is whether or not the script has a serif font or no serifs. And the no serifs is definitely more popular, and so the serif is a little bit more old feeling, and I notice that stands out to me, but maybe not necessarily in a good way. The Terry Goddard one here, it's got the Roadrunner Secretary of State, and you know we do have Roadrunners here, but I would say that that is sort of an odd choice. It may be that he's faster, maybe that he's local. But I think that some of the other signs that they have a graphic on them that relates more to what it is that they are trying to express, more specific and more understandable to the you know, average person who's walking by.
And the Roadrunner's background is green. I'm not sure if that's significant either.
Yeah, it looks sort of like a running shoe design to me. And he's running for Secretary of State, and then it also says Stop Dark Money. And I'm not really sure how those things all fit together.
Okay, Peter, we've crossed the street. So what are we looking at now?
The two that jump out to me are one that says re-elect Deanne McClenahan for the high school board. And it's green with white text. But then what makes it different from most of the other ones that we've seen so far is that it's got her photograph, a headshot of her on it. And I think that you know, definitely stands out. But I'm not sure how much that would make me change my vote.
What do you think it does for the poster? Because it's taking up maybe a quarter of that poster. Do you think that's wise use of space?
I guess, like, in terms of bang for your buck, I think that it probably isn't as good use of space. But if you've got more money for your campaign, then I would say that then it might be a good choice. So the last one that we've got here on this corner is re-elect Adlisser Mendez Sherwood, Education, Jobs, Community. And most of the time when I have my students design posters that are for advertising, I tell them not to do a white background. And I think that this one actually is a fairly, I like the white background on this. It's because we've got the red text, and then we also have blue bars that create white text with the same white background. And, you know, it's all the same font. It's all justified, which means that it is not to the left side or to the right side. All the letters are spaced out so that we've got straight lines on the left and the right, and it looks like just one big block of text, but it's still very easy to read. There's not too much information, so on the whole, I'd say it's a well-designed sign.
If you were to pick where you would put a sign to get the biggest bang, do you want an area that has several signs as long as yours is still seen because people are thinking a lot of signs, or would you want to be just one on the corner by yourself?
I think it's like gas stations or Starbucks, that they know where the good spots are, and so you should go where those other signs are, unless you have some inside information. You know, without being a political consultant or knowing too much myself, I think that the places where signs are, when we talked about where to meet, I knew that this was a place where we would find signs, even if I didn't know what those signs were.
Artist Peter Bug of ASU's Herberger Institute of Design and the Arts.
Still to come, the Valley's NHL team really, really would like your support.
We want to be the number one team in the Valley, and we understand that hockey in Arizona, until you kind of establish the fact that you're a premier team, it's going to be hard to kind of make headway.
We'll face off with Shane Doan of the Arizona Coyotes. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It is the show on KJZZ at 226. Checking Valley traffic. A lot of accidents have come in over the last half hour or so. 60 westbound at I-10. Also the 101 southbound at the 202 Santan Freeway. And if you're on I-17 southbound, look out for a collision at Glendale. Skies should be clear tonight around the Valley as we gradually dry out. Look for low temperatures in the upper 60s. For this weekend, sunny tomorrow with a high of 92. Sunny and 90 on Sunday. Currently, we're sunny and 86 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Art Center. Direct from This American Life, humorist David Sedaris shares new stories and old favorites with biting satire and droll charm. David Sedaris, November 5th. Tickets at mesaartcenter.com.
There are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
That bit of logic comes courtesy of then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in 2002. That line and all of the events following the September 11th terrorist attacks are the basis for an exhibit at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. It's called Covert Operations, Investigating the Known Unknowns, and it hits you right away. The bell is part of the exhibit. Each hour, it rings once for each Iraqi civilian who's died that day because of violence. Claire Carter, the curator of contemporary art at SMOCA, says the piece, called Memorial for a New American Century, is connected to a website which updates the number of Iraqi civilian deaths.
The bell is hundreds and hundreds of pounds. It's a very beautiful, has this gorgeous resonant sound. It's a call to mourn, and it imparts that somber significance. It's also very demanding. It requires you to stop and reflect.
Carter says most of the pieces in the show have been on display in solo exhibits. And even though she considers it a historical show, almost all of the pieces are from 2005 or later. One of the exceptions is set to look like an interrogation room. It's a 16mm film showing images of people who answered a casting call for people who look like terrorists.
As you sit here and you look at this piece, you not only have to reflect on your own judgments, well, that person, that woman doesn't look like a terrorist. Wait, why do I think that? You also have this other complicated question, which is, how does this person self-identify as a terrorist?
Carter says she wants those questions to make visitors stop and reflect. But for the answers, she says, we're on our own.
The artists do not provide one answer and one political perspective, but rather they have appeared as observers, and it's as though they're reporting back to us.
Ultimately, what all of the work in the show is trying to do is really look at a complex set of situations really dispassionately and prompt questions. I think the show does that really well.
Artist David Taylor's photographs are taken at the U.S.-Mexico border. He says generally, art and politics have an uneasy relationship.
When we expect art to function in an activist mode, it oftentimes runs up against the contradictions of the marketplace and the viewership that most ordinarily gravitates toward museums and galleries.
Taylor says many of the artists in the show have been able to navigate that by taking on timely subjects. The exhibit looks at surveillance, intelligence, and trafficking, among other issues. Again, SMOCA's Claire Carter.
I walked through the exhibition with a very prominent politician, and his response was one that surprised me. He saw these artworks and said, "This is the kind of information that needs to be discussed in order to keep politicians accountable."
In reading about some of the pieces, it looks like a lot of the artists have used techniques that are more apt to be used, for example, by journalists or policy people as opposed to artists. I mean, we're not just talking about art techniques, we're talking about freedom of information requests, things like that. Is that unusual for artists to be doing?
One of the most exciting questions that contemporary art asks is, what is art and what can art be? And therefore, I'll say that unusual in that the majority of contemporary artists are not working in this way. However, if media's responsibility is to provide us with information, art's responsibility is to allow us to reflect on the messages. This exhibition is so entwined with the years following 9/11. There's absolutely no way that this artwork would exist without these tectonic shifts in our understanding of the world, our safety, the role of democracy versus totalitarianism, freedom versus security, and the ability of these artists to gather information from around the world without actually having to travel, again, would not have happened without the advent of such massive sharing of information because of the internet.
Covert operations will be on display at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art through mid-January.
The 2014-2015 NHL season has been advertised as a season of change for the Valley's hockey team. The most obvious change is in the name, from Phoenix Coyotes to Arizona Coyotes. And as of last week, another ownership change is in the works, with hedge fund manager Andrew Barraway in negotiations to buy 51% of the team. Now let's take a deep breath. One person has provided stability to the Coyotes on and off the ice. It's team captain Shane Doan, who's been a part of the organization for 20 years. He says it's challenging to be the player most associated with a team.
there's more pressure and you take more responsibility in the fact the longer you're around, you feel that it's, and I think that's great. You want that. You need that. I think that it brings out more in you. It gives you, it makes you more accountable to your teammates. It makes everybody more accountable to everyone. And I mean, you want to be associated with winning more than anything. And last 2 years, we haven't made the playoffs, and that's really what dictates everything. The year before, we got to the conference final against the soon-to-be Stanley Cup champions that year, and we were close, and we want to get back to that spot.
You're the captain of this team. What are the responsibilities that go with that on and off the ice?
Yeah, in hockey, it's different, and they put a C on you, and everyone sees it, and it's considerably more, I think, public than a lot of the other sports. In hockey, you're really the liaison between the coaches and the players. On top of that, you're expected to be the leader off the ice and hold the guys accountable. And the big thing for hockey players is making sure that guys are kind of following the rules and doing what you're supposed to do as a professional hockey player. And I think that's important.
How big a difference can home ice make in hockey in the regular season? Playoffs, people talk about it a lot. In the regular season, how important is it to have a crazy fan base really going wild for you?
Every athlete has a huge ego. I mean, there is no doubt about that. And we love to play in front of more people. The more people, the better it is. And it's fun playing in front of your home crowd, and you love it. There's no question about it.
NHL, at least in this market, sometimes gets short shrift. I mean, you know, that which is just reality. So how do you feel about where you stand? Is it important for you guys to get as much attention as the NFL? Is it just, hey, you're doing your thing?
We want to be the number one team. We want to be the number one. I mean, just the same way they do. In the Valley, and we understand that hockey in Arizona, until you kind of establish the fact that you're a premier team, it's going to be hard to kind of make headway. But at the same time, we know that there's enough Canadians that come down here and people from the north that really enjoy the game, that if we find a way to get some positive kind of momentum going in the right direction, that we do really well.
The Suns seem to be back on the rise, but they went through some rebuilding years. The Cardinals had rebuilding years. What does it take to get out of the rebuilding sort of rotation to make sure that there's consistent winning as opposed to winning a couple of years and then we're back down again and that sort of thing?
The last 2 years, things haven't went the way we wanted getting into the playoffs. That being said, we stuck more to our system and more to our way than maybe in the past, got really focused on it again, and I think that's going to pay dividends in the long run. But you want to get out of that. Yeah, rebuilding is terrible, especially if you're an experienced player that wants to find a way to win a Stanley Cup. That rebuilding doesn't work. I don't think we're in that process. I think we're close, and we got to make some good decisions here going forward, and we got to have some guys play to the level that we think they can get to.
Arizona Coyotes captain Shane Doan. The team started the season last night against the Winnipeg Jets, losing 6-2.
So Shane Doan says the Coyotes aren't rebuilding, but other teams in the Valley, including the Arizona Diamondbacks, clearly are.
Matt Berry is an ESPN anchor who grew up in Scottsdale and graduated from ASU. He's also worked in Dallas and Denver and says Phoenix isn't alone in having teams that don't win consistently.
You've got the Denver Broncos, you've got the Avalanche, you've got the Rockies, you've got the Nuggets. Rockies, year in and year out, aren't great. Nuggets had a good run at a George Karl and Carmelo Anthony. And the Broncos just recently got good because they signed Peyton Manning, got him some weapons, and now they're one of the best teams in the AFC. And so I think if you look at it from the standpoint of other cities, you could probably see a lot of comparisons between a lot of them. Look at Chicago, for instance. The Cubs have been bad since, what, 1908? The White Sox had some success a few years back, winning the World Series, but the Bears haven't really done much lately. The Bulls haven't done much lately. So in comparison to other cities with the four pro sports teams, you have to kind of take a step back and understand how hard it is to actually win a championship. The last time we saw an Arizona team really have an opportunity in the four major sports, we're going back to Kurt Warner and the Arizona Cardinals against the Pittsburgh Steelers in the Super Bowl, where he left the field a Super Bowl champion only to watch Ben Roethlisberger come down the field and get the win.
Matt, what about going to the Suns? Is this an organization that is considered to be more than just fun time run up and down the court?
You know, it's funny, growing up in Arizona, growing up in Scottsdale, the one team that we could count on year in and year out, it was the Phoenix Suns. Tom Chambers, Kevin Johnson, Dan Marley, Jeff Hornacek, and all these players, the Phoenix Suns were that one franchise. We said, you know what, they're going to make the playoffs every year, and they're our best hope for a championship out there in the Valley. And it, for whatever reason, over the course of the last 5 years, that franchise is just struggled to compete in a loaded Western Conference. they've got the talent to succeed, and it's clear that they're going to get that organization going back in the right direction. I still believe the Suns are going to be the best chance to get the Valley a championship. People just have to be patient. The time is coming. I understand how people out there feel, but if you just take a look at each franchise and the success and the failures, it is very, very, very hard to sustain success over a long period of time.
ESPN anchor and Scottsdale native Matt Berry. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Mark Rowett. I work at Davis Salvage Company, and we are a metal service and recycling center. The raw material would come in its larger form. They probably have to be 3 foot pieces or shorter, so they'll get processed down to that size. There's a big conveyor belt at the very front of it. This is where you would drop the material. The belt brings it up and feeds it into a chamber that it gets dropped into, and that's when they crush it and smash it. We basically made about a 3,000 pound cube of material. A lot of the people that bring material in are doing it for the money, but it's also good for the earth. You're recycling and you're reusing something, so you're kind of not depleting the earth's natural resources.
That's Mark Browett, General Manager at Davis Salvage Company in Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to recycle us, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Coming up, country legend Marty Stewart on his new album and his efforts to preserve country music.
Is that it's very best when that authenticity shines through. As a culture, I felt it slipping away. I felt it disappearing, and it seemed too precious to me to let that happen.
That's still to come. It's the show.
Good afternoon. Heavy traffic starting early around the valley. Watch out for a lot of accidents. I-17 southbound at Adams. It's blocking the left lane. If you're on the 101 southbound in the East Valley, couple of collisions, one at University, the other at Broadway. And a couple center lanes blocked, 202 eastbound, the Santan Freeway at Alma School. Looking for sunny skies tomorrow around the valley with a high of 92. It's mostly sunny and 86 degrees.
In a quick check of news from KJZZ, the U.S. Supreme Court is allowing same-sex marriages to go forward in Idaho. A federal appeals court Tuesday overturned gay marriage bans in Idaho and Nevada. Idaho appealed to the Supreme Court for an emergency stay one day later, which it got. After reviewing a filing from plaintiffs in the case, the court removed the stay without comment just a few minutes ago.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing Steak Lovers, with a selection of USDA Prime and USDA Choice steaks, as well as grass-fed New York strips and ribeyes. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
The first ever mariachi opera comes to the Valley this weekend, as Arizona Opera presents Cruzar la Cara de la Luna, or To Cross the Face of the Moon. It tells the story of one man, Laurentino, who comes to America as part of the Bracero program in the 1960s. Cecilia Duarte plays Laurentino's wife, Renata.
The story talks mainly about the concept of home and where it's home or what is home. What does it mean? And for all of us living in the United States, you know, coming from different places or being away from our family, it brings up a lot of emotions. And, you know, the story we tell, it's pretty strong.
Tendrás y tendrás 10 veces más hijos porque recibirás 10 veces más amor porque serás 10 veces más 10 veces más hombre.
Can you talk about your character a little bit?
Yes, my character is Renata. I'm the wife of Laurentino, the man that comes to the United States to work through the Bracero program back in the 60s. And I'm the wife that stays in Mexico, in Michoacán, taking care of our son and, you know, just receiving all the money Laurentino's making. And so I have the most beautiful house in town. Suddenly I have the best clothes and I have tons of food and I need, you know, I have everything I need for me and for my son, but I don't have my husband. Renata's priority is to have her family together. And of course she wants to support her husband's decision, but at the same time, she starts suffering the consequences of being away from him and, you know, feeling lonely and suddenly seeing a town that has no men because everybody is gone. She wants to change that situation and that reality, so she takes a step and goes forth to look for him.
Nuestra madre y nuestro padre se juntaron bajo el cielo.
When you are backstage getting yourself ready, and you've performed this role obviously many times before, is it all about what is in this performance? Do you bring back your own memories? Do you bring back your own personal experiences? What forms the character you bring to the stage?
I love that question because I think every time is a different experience for us. We make them part of ourselves. You know, we add what our experiences, or during the course of all this time, I have heard so many stories about people that have gone through that situation. And sometimes it's people I know that I'm close to or that I care about. So it becomes more personal, because I'm representing someone's story, but I know someone has gone through that. Here in Arizona, it's been so special for us because we are closer. We are like a family. We know each other very well. And so I think it only becomes more powerful and more real when it's time to perform.
When I see a classical performance and I love something, I get shushed if I decide I really want to express myself. Is anything different about this particular opera where people might be able to, because of the mariachi, they might be able to express themselves a little bit differently in the audience?
Yes, definitely. There's a moment in the opera, I don't want to give it away, you know, but there we have some surprises there. And I think it's very common. The first time the mariachi starts playing, we have a, you know, a huge like ovation from the people. They all start clapping no matter what's going on.
Mariposas recién nacidas elevan el vuelo y nunca han viajado.
Cecilia Duarte, who portrays Renata in Arizona Opera's Cruzar la Cara de la Luna. There are performances tonight and Saturday night and Sunday afternoon at Phoenix Symphony Hall.
Antepasados de nuestra gente regresan benditos, amados difuntos.
The Arizona State Fair opened today, and along with all the deep-fried goodness, visitors can check out a building that's been in the news for a non-fair-related reason. This summer, a judge blocked the fair from demolishing the Civic Building, built in 1938, which served as a headquarters for the Works Progress Administration. Bob Graham, an architect specializing in historic preservation, says this isn't the only historic building at the fairgrounds that'll need some attention. He says the WPA building and others have been neglected for a long time.
The fairgrounds is kind of a chronically underfunded agency, so it just hasn't received any loving care in many years, and so it's in a rundown condition, and just how rundown it is a matter of contention a little bit.
I mean, do you get the sense, and not having been inside, but do you get the sense that there's just some, like, touch-up work that needs to be done? I mean, do you think there's going to be serious structural-type things that have to be fixed?
The state fair had an assessment done by a structural engineering company, and that structural engineering report actually said that there are no structural components that are in imminent danger of collapse or that require substantial removal or demolition. People go in and they see leaking roofs and they see cracks in walls, and that gets them very concerned. But based on this, the assessment that they had done, it looks like it's, you know, while I'm sure that there's a substantial amount of rehabilitation work that needs to be done, it's not that the building's going to fall down or anything like that.
It sounds like it's somewhere between a total gut job and like a coat of paint somewhere.
I would call what probably needs to happen as a substantial rehab. And this happens all the time with historic buildings because of the lack of maintenance. And it's not unusual for that to cost a lot of money, but it should be cost effective to put the building back into use in a productive manner rather than tearing it down and basically just using a parking lot.
In a building like that, of that age, are there certain uses for it that are better than others once they're rehabilitated?
Well, certainly it's always preferred to use a historic building for its original use if you can, because that requires the least changes to the building. And then going up the scale, you'd want to use it for things that do require minimal alteration. Now, the actual structure of the building lends itself to a lot of things, but part of the problem is that the fairground doesn't have a lot of indoor uses that they need.
Ultimately, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, there's been a committee set up with the State Fair working together with the City of Phoenix and interested preservation professionals to try to work out exactly where we go from here. And then the real challenge is between the state, the city, and the private sector, can we find a good use that makes this building pay for itself and a way to fund a rehabilitation so that we keep it around? We need to get it off of the liability column for the State Fair and make it an asset for them, just like the other buildings. And this isn't the only building at the State Fair that's got this problem. We have other historic buildings there that are also in danger, but this is just the one that was in the worst shape. So in the long term, we hope to try to come up with a plan together with the State Fairgrounds to make their historic buildings an asset for them.
Bob Graham is an architect at the Phoenix-based firm Motley Design Group and specializes in historic preservation.
Archaeologists checking out new parts of Petrified Forest National Park have made a pretty big find, a large basket maker site. Park archaeologist Bill Reitze says this is the second such village found in 2 years. He says usually they have one or two structures each. These have upwards of 50 to 75.
These patterns combined with other patterns throughout the region have the potential to really show us kind of more about how people kind of transition from being more nomadic groups to actually becoming more sedentary and investing in landscapes and building houses and staying in one place. It also shows us how people might be starting to rely more and more on agriculture, which happens during this time period as well.
Reitze says scientists can also find out about the artifacts people living there used, since the sites have some of the earliest ceramics on the Colorado Plateau, and he doesn't expect this find to be the last.
The archaeological density, so the number of sites out there, is much, much higher than we anticipated. So I assume that we're going to continue to find a lot of new archaeology and be able to answer a lot of new questions as the park continues to work out there.
Reitze says archaeologists will keep inventorying the park's new land. Congress in 2004 authorized the park to nearly double in size. Reitze says last year the Park Service opened up about 14,000 acres of new land to the public.
Every state has one governor, right? Well, actually, that wasn't the case at one point in Arizona. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us about a time when our state had two at the same time.
The 1916 gubernatorial election results were close, really close. In fact, when incumbent George Hunt lost to challenger Thomas Campbell, Hunt refused to concede. Did you know that for nearly 30 days, Arizona had two governors?
George Hunt is a well-known politician. He's still well-known to this day as being the first elected governor for the state of Arizona. He served in a number of legislative groups and committees prior to becoming a state.
Luke Bate is a historian at the Arizona Capitol Museum.
Thomas Campbell had a parallel career. He had served in territorial and state offices. He'd been a member of the Arizona Tax Commission. So they were political adversaries, and they were both well-known, both prominent.
As we walk through the Capitol Museum, Bate describes the race. It was almost a popularity contest. Both men were respected. Campbell was a native of the state. Hunt was a two-time governor. But Campbell attacked Hunt during the campaign for increasing taxes and being disconnected from the people. And it looked like the attacks worked.
Thomas Campbell wins the popular vote, but George Hunt wants to contest this result.
That's because the final count had Campbell winning by a margin of just 30 votes.
Hunt challenged that decision, saying that there were instances of vote fraud that hadn't been resolved.
most of his argument basically had to do with the fact that people voted twice.
David Berman is with ASU's Morrison Institute. He's written a book about Governor Hunt.
They voted a straight party ticket, which covered all the offices once you put that X in the circle. And they voted for Campbell.
Ultimately, Campbell was declared the winner. The new governor took the oath of office, and so did Hunt. Berman says Hunt was to step down on December 30th, but instead, he locked himself in the governor's suite. He refused to let Campbell take over while his challenges were being decided in court. On January 27th, 1917, the Arizona Supreme Court ruled Campbell the governor. Hunt stepped down, but he continued to challenge the election results.
Didn't do very well in the courts until way in December of that year, and finally got the state Supreme Court to reverse the lower court.
The state Supreme Court ruled that ballots with X marks for both gubernatorial candidates should be thrown out. It was almost a whole year later when Hunt was declared the official winner in 1917. He finished the remainder of the two-year term. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you know things that we should know, tell us about them. The show at KJZZ.org. Quick check of Valley traffic. Accidents 101 southbound in the East Valley at University. That has the right lane blocked. Also 51 southbound at the I-10. The accident there has the right lane blocked. Pretty significant slowing on the 202 westbound from about Van Buren right on into the 51.
You probably know legendary country musician Marty Stewart from songs like Hillbilly Rock. It comes from Mississippi and down in Alabama. Marty Stewart's new double album, called Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, is made up of two distinct parts. The first half is the rock and country he's best known for, and the other half is gospel. There is a land where I'm going. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry caught up with Marty Stewart, who's currently on tour and will be playing in Tucson on Tuesday night.
I'm standing a bit on my Mississippi roots because, if you go to the history books, you'll find so much American and roots music royalty that came from down there. Well, I woke up this morning with miles of life behind me. My friends and family worry, 'cause they don't know where to find me.
At first, it may seem like gritty country and gospel music don't have much in common, but Marty Stewart has always seen a close relationship between them.
The one thing that linked all of those genres together was the church house and, the sounds of gospel music. It was just kind of in the air. It influenced the blues, it influenced rock and roll, it influenced country music, jazz, classical. And it influenced the literary society down there. So I think the church house is kind of ground zero for all things, especially, where I come from. Well, I'm one day closer than I've ever
been before. This was true in particular during Stewart's childhood in Philadelphia, Mississippi. In 1964, three civil rights workers were murdered there, and national attention turned to the rural town. Stewart says there were a few songs that defined that time that still stick with him today, like Uncloudy Day, made famous by the Staple Singers. Stewart teamed up with Mavis Staples to record the song for his new album. Oh, they tell me of a home far beyond the sky.
I mean, it was an awful time, unthinkable. But the song Uncloudy Day by the Staple Singers kind of became an anthem down in that part of the country at that time. You could hear it coming off of radio stations repeatedly in a daily format. You could hear it coming out of people's houses when you'd walk by. It just became a part of me. Oh, they tell me of a home where no storms climb.
Stewart has been in the country music world for over 40 years, so he's seen it change a lot. In that time, country music has become highly commercial, and many argue that it's strayed from its humble beginnings.
It's at its very best when that authenticity shines through. As a culture, I felt it slipping away. I felt it disappearing, and it seemed too precious to me to let that happen. My mission for the past 7 or 8 years especially has been to preserve it, promote it, cherish what's left of it, but the main thing is to introduce it to a new generation of people.
Well, that old train come rolling right through my backyard. When it went across that levee, I was crying so hard.
He's done that through careful archiving, photographing his fellow country legends behind the scenes, and collecting country music memorabilia. His collections have been displayed in museums, giving regular folks a chance to peek in at the lives of so many iconic musicians. And Stewart says that in a way, being so surrounded by the lives and music of other country legends put some added pressure on him. But ultimately, it makes him better.
When I think about writing a song, if I could, in my mind, have enough courage, if Hank Williams or Johnny Cash or Patsy Cline or Merle Travis or Waylon was standing there, and I would go, you know, if I had enough confidence to play it for any one of those people, I know I have a good song in my hand. And so it's sometimes good to know that those hillbilly angels are up there watching sometimes.
There's an old, old house that once was a mansion on a hill overlooking the town.
That's KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Marty Stewart will be performing at the Rialto Theater in Tucson on Tuesday night.
A little bit sooner, some good stuff going on this weekend, including the Four Peaks Oktoberfest at Tempe Town Lake, beer, bratwurst, and lederhosen.
Mark, I might get divorced if I don't mention the Greater Phoenix Greek Festival. That's this weekend at Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox in Phoenix. It's the oldest Greek festival in the Valley.
Also, the Scottsdale International Film Festival at Harkins Shea 14 in Scottsdale. That runs through Monday.
Gem Rock and Mineral Show. That's all weekend at Hell's a Poppin' Arena in Buckeye. That's really worth the trip just for the name of the arena.
Absolutely. Of course, the State Fair opened at noon today. Lots of interesting deep-fried things you can eat there. Some concerts going on, rides, games, attractions, good people watching there.
And as you heard earlier this hour on the show, Arizona Opera presents the first mariachi opera. That's going on all weekend as well. Nighttime shows tonight and Saturday, and then a matinee on Sunday.
The show was produced this week by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nick Blumberg, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. We're at the show at kjzz.org.
For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.